This is how we overcome. We're moving the new kingdom. Reaching to the world with arms open. Arms open, yeah. This is how we practice great.
Well, welcome back to Crazy Faith Talk. I'm Erica.
I'm Sarah.
And I'm Steve.
So friends, this is the last episode of our Lenten series for 2024, Temptations for the Church. So we've been looking at some temptations that we think the church, capital C church, seems to be facing. Things like Christian nationalism, the temptation to be relevant, the temptation to be judgy. And last week we talked about the temptation to prosperity gospel. So where are we going today?
Today we thought we would talk about the temptation for the church to be the savior rather than to point to the savior. Like to think that it's the church's job to take Jesus' role away from him, to be the be-all, end-all, I guess. And there's a lot of different directions that we could explore this. Maybe help lay out some of them. What does it look like? What could it look like when the church wants to be the savior rather than to let Jesus be the savior?
We need to be the source, like the place where everybody comes to fix all their problems.
Okay.
Like, so we host the food bank, we host the clothing bank, we host all the things so that people have to come to us to get the help that they need, rather than seeing that there might, you know, and they have to come to our church, not like to a church. They have to come to our church.
Okay.
They can't
don't go to the one down the street.
Right.
Yeah, don't go to the Catholics down the street.
Don't go to
the Baptist down the street. Or yeah.
Go to this one.
No, you got to come to this one, and in every church on the block.
It's saying
like
the
where
same
I'm seeing
thing.
Right now, there's like five churches on the street. Are all saying like, yeah, you have to come here to this specific church.
So in the attempt to try and do good work, and again, like nobody's saying that feeding neighbors is a bad idea, but when it becomes a sort of parochial possessive control thing of you have to come here, we've got to be the ones to give it to you, and don't trust those people down the street, that now it's I'm elbowing Jesus out of the way, whose primary concern is that hungry people get fed, and we've turned it into a we've got to get credit for doing the good work and not those people down the street. Okay, that's a piece of it. This reminds me too, I'm gonna only get the idea roughly, not the quote, but there was an insight of Nietzsche's that sticks with me. One of his criticisms about Christianity, he's got a lot of them, but one of his criticisms of Christianity is that it felt to him like Christians need there to be suffering in the world so that they can be the ones who get to alleviate it. That like that secretly, and Christians don't want to admit this, he would say, but like Christians don't actually want a world where there's no hunger or no homelessness or whatever. We need there to be suffering so that we can be the ones who go and meet that need so we can have our own sense of purpose and identity. So rather than a vision of we should eliminate poverty or there should not be a world where people are hungry, Christians kind of want there to be that for our, like that we built our identity on that. And I think that's a powerful critique that's worth always asking. Yeah, are we looking to just put Band-Aids on things because that's what we think our job is, and we don't know who to be if we're not that? Or do we actually care about alleviating suffering? That's a hard question, because I think sometimes if our identity is wrapped up in, but this is what we do, we wouldn't know what to do if all of a sudden there wasn't hunger or there wasn't the hurt or whatever.
Right.
You might say that some of the movements in theology in the 20th century, like what's sometimes called the theology of hope, the movement like associated with Jürgen Moltmann, who talks about the Christian life is meant to be oriented toward God's future when all things are made new, when there isn't poverty, when, to borrow a favorite passage of the good Reverend Sarah, God makes all things new in the new creation in Revelation 21. like, if we build our theology around that, then like hopefully that does change. And like, yeah, our goal is to put ourselves out of business. The goal is when everybody's fed, when everybody, you know, is has their needs met, when God finally is all in all and all tears are wiped away. But that critique is an important one. And maybe it's worth us asking periodically in our own church life, are we just trying to perpetuate this problem so that we feel like we're doing something good in the world and can pat ourselves on the back?
I think to me that sounds a whole lot like, what is our intent when we are doing good in the world?
Okay.
Like, are we doing good in the world to be doing the good, as in like we do generally care about the people that we are feeding, because we don't want them to be hungry, or are we feeding the hungry just so we can pat ourselves on the back?
Right. And maybe it gets even at like structural or process kinds of things. Like if we have a certain amount of resource as a church and we say we want to help the hunger problem, and we think the only thing we should do is give out bowls of soup rather than what would help people to be able to in their own households, be their families. Like, what would help? What can we do that help get people job training? Or what? I mean, like, there's ways too to think about, am I just here to give out bowls of soup and we can measure our success in terms of number of bowls of soup dished out? Or are we actually trying to get people out of poverty? Like, that's I think, a worthwhile question. And there's ways we could be spending our time and resource that wouldn't be condescending to people. Like, you must be sort of pitiably through the soup line, and we can be the ones patronizing you sort of condescendingly. Or how can we treat you as a neighbor, and how can we, what can we do that would help people to get out of the cycle of poverty so that neighborhoods can actually improve? Or, like, to me, that feels like part of the conversation too. And some churches are sort of built on, no, we're the church that has the soup kitchen. We don't actually want people to actually, be out of poverty. We need to be the church that has the soup kitchen. That's our identity. Like, I remember maybe it's been 10, 15 years ago, there was a push within our denomination body, the ELCA, partnering with some of the Lutheran churches in Tanzania to eradicate malaria. And it was like the vision was clear. It was like, there are the treatments available. You can, there's preventative things like mosquito nets. There's drugs and medicines that could do this. And the way it was presented was, we're not just making malaria clinics where people who have malaria can, like, have their symptoms managed. This is something that could actually be eradicated if people would say it's more important to spend my resource on this than on a bigger TV at my house. I mean, but the goal was, yeah, this could be eradicated. This actually could be managed and done. To me, like, that felt like that got clearly the goal is actually, like, deeper systemic. How do we actually help solve a problem? And not, we kind of need the problem to keep happening so that we can have a sense of we're the people who bind the band, bandage the wounds. There's that other line of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And please, listeners, we don't get a kickback every time we mention Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's just he's useful. But there's a line of his where he says that and he's speaking as like what Christians are called to do. We're not just meant to bandage the victims of those who get trampled under the wheel of injustice. We're supposed to drive a spoke through that wheel. Like, in other words, to stop the causes of what the problem is in the first place. Or there's an insight of Desmond Tutu who says something like, if you keep fishing people out of the river and saving them from drowning, that's great. But at some point, someone should go upstream and find out who's pushing people in the river and stop them from pushing people in the river. And I guess I feel like that's an important question to ask, because if all we ever see ourselves as we're the people who fish people out of the river, it sounds like we built our business model around that's, we don't really care that people are drowning in the first place. Our sense of worth is tied to how many people did we fish out of the river, rather than envisioning a day when nobody's, drowning in the first place.
And it's so easy to get caught up in this kind of stuff, I think, because some of these issues we're talking about, like feeding the hungry and getting people out of poverty, seem so huge that we don't know how to fix that, especially when we're only working within our own church, but even if we're working at a denominational level, because like the United Methodist Church, my former connection had that the same thing with malaria. It was called Nothing But Nets. My former bishop helped get that started. It when we look at this and we're like, okay, yes, we can feed people now, but how do we get them to a place where they can feed themselves? Like, it becomes too much, or it seems to be too much.
And again, like, I think you're raising good questions. Like, we got to be, any one of us has to ask this question, not just at the big picture level, but when someone comes to our door and is in need of food, talking about big systemic social change doesn't fill their belly. And so, how do we do it both? And, like, okay, what do we do big picture to help people? But also, when my neighbor is in front of me and is hungry, good news for them is they need to be able to feed their kids. What do we do to help them be able to feed their kids? Both of those are valid parts of what our mission might look like.
Because I think I love the metaphor of fishing people out of the river who's drowning, but we got to also go upstream and like figuring out how are the people getting in the river in the first place. Because even as you send somebody upstream to figure out what's going on, you can't stop pulling people out of the river. I was on when I was on internship, we were getting ready for a funeral one day, and somebody came to the church hungry and looking for food, and we didn't have a food pantry. And I was trying to point him in the direction of the Salvation Army, who did have like a daily lunch for people. And but like for whatever reason, that wasn't working out for him. And so I was asking these questions, trying to get to the bottom of like, well, why isn't this working? Why isn't that like the system that we have across all the churches in this town not working? Like, let me get to the bottom of this. And my supervisor had to like stop me and go, Sarah, he's hungry right now. They're making lunch right now downstairs for this funeral. Let's all go downstairs and get him a bite to eat. And it was like, and it took me a moment to realize, yes, I was trying to go upstream and figure out this long-term solution problem thing. And but at this right moment, he needed a sandwich, and we had sandwiches downstairs.
Your example is so helpful to me because I often find myself wrestling in the role of pastor with like anytime someone comes to the church's door or phone call and it's some kind of need for help, obviously there's always some question about like how do you keep the church's resources from being taken advantage of, and you don't, for example, want someone just coming to the door asking for cash and giving cash because you don't know how that's going to be used and you want to make sure it's used well. In your example, it was here's a person, the thing they've said they need is they're hungry. We can give food in kind and solve that problem. But also, like, to me, it feels like part of letting Jesus be Jesus is also meaning I won't necessarily get to be the final judge of whether somebody has used the resources we give them well or not. That's up to Jesus to deal with. My calling is I'll be the one who risks feeding. And so if that means that I can go with the person, we don't happen to be hosting a funeral lunch at the time that someone comes to the door, but I've got the time, can I go buy you lunch and we'll sit together and eat it? And like there's a I'm not just throwing money and making you go away, but like okay, if that's the issue and running the you run the risk that sometimes people may take advantage of generosity. But to me it feels like letting Jesus be Jesus is okay, Jesus will take care of sorting that piece out. My job is not to decide who's worthy or not worthy. Jesus has given us the command to feed our neighbors. So I guess that's maybe another piece of this whole temptation is if we want to be the savior, we also kind of want to be the final judge. And to say, nope, Jesus has given us a set of instructions that run the risk. You might from time to time get taken advantage of. You might help somebody else, and they've also gotten help from another church, and that's okay. In the end, Jesus will sort out the finances of it. But our calling is not to play the role of Jesus. Sorry, I can't help you because I can't verify every fact about you. I mean, we can try not to get taken advantage of when it's other people's money, when it's the church's money that you're in charge of dispersing, but we can also err on the side of generosity because that's our commandment. This reminds me too of that famous saying about evangelism. I think I've heard it attributed to D.T. Niles that evangelism is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. And in my mind, the thing that's helpful about that image is it reminds me that I'm not the source doling out the good things. Jesus still gets to be that. And sometimes the church's temptation is, no, we are the source of all good things. You must come to us, and rather than, nope, we are also people who've been fed as well. And if we see ourselves as recipients of grace, then it's a lot easier for me to see somebody else who's also in need of grace and to say, yeah, I was hungry too, and I found a place, or I've been blessed with what I needed, so I will help you, rather than I'm the one who doles out gifts and I determine who's worthy or not. The church is not in the business of deciding who's worthy. We're beggars who've also been fed. To me, like, that's an important reminder that hopefully keeps us out of the role of seeing ourselves as savior.
I like to think of both my role as pastor, but also as our role as church together, is we are John the Baptist. We are not Jesus. That we are the continually pointing to Jesus and going, that is the source of salvation. That is the source of love. It's not me. I'm just the finger pointing.
Yep.
And I think that's helpful to remember what our role is in this situation. We're John the Baptist.
Yeah.
We're pointing. We are doing those things that are in alignment with what Jesus is doing, but we ourselves are not Jesus.
Yeah. I went to an art exhibit at our local art museum a couple weeks back. They were doing a series of paintings by Caravaggio. And the little audio tour that you hold up to your ear like a cell phone, the experts kept talking about a concept I don't think I had heard before. It was implied lines. And they said, when a figure in a painting is pointing in a certain direction, or their hand is gesturing a certain way, or when their eyes are looking in a particular direction, it does something psychologically when you watch it that you want to follow where their eyes are going to look, where they're going, or where their fingers are pointing. And so, like, at first glance, I'd be like, ah, it's a painting, some people. And then you'd listen to the guide, and they'd be like, no, look at this, look at all this action going on. This person's, you know, hand is pointing in this direction. It makes you look over here, and then it makes you look over here. And there's like five things going on that I didn't realize at first blush. And it feels to me like it's that same kind of idea that we're called to be like those implied lines, like who point people in the direction of Jesus. And that at first blush, it might not look like much is going on. But yeah, that our role is that, how do we point beyond ourselves? I really appreciate your image of being like John the Baptizer that way, the people who point ahead. Yeah. Are there other ways that this temptation to cast ourselves as the savior rather than Jesus shows up in contemporary church life? Are there other ways that you see this as an issue?
Yeah, I think that a common way that this will pop up is when congregations are ready to hire or call a new pastor or leader.
Okay.
And there is always the temptation to try to find the church's Messiah, their savior. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, if we just call this type of person, then they'll fix all of our problems and we will be saved. We will grow. We won't close. We won't die out. If we only call the right person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then all of that responsibility to save the church is now on that one new leader that you're calling in.
And that then, like, assumes that part of a savior's job is to make a church work the way we want it to, rather than to say, no, what Jesus has done in the world is adequate. That may or may not mean that attendance or does this, or that our budget looks like this. But yeah, that we sometimes want other people to be additional saviors of an institution or a congregation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
One of my, you know, as a pastor who has moved around a lot in part of a clergy couple, and as a pastor who's worked in mobility recently, I've been to a lot of installations of pastors. You know, that's the worship service that celebrates the new ministry between a pastor and a congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite ones, like one of my favorite sermons that I've heard at one of those services, was one of my husband's, actually. And Bishop Jones stood up and had this great sermon about how my husband wasn't the Messiah, that he wasn't going to be able to do X, Y, and Z, because those are things that Jesus has already done or is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that Russ's role was to do this as mm-hmm. his role as pastor and work with the congregation to solve some of their problems. But then some of those problems probably would outlast Russ. But it was a very, very good sermon, I thought. And probably should have raised some red flags for me at that time of like, oh, I think the bishop might know something that I don't know about this call. But to me, it was a really good sermon because it was very much like, yes, Russ isn't the Messiah. Any pastor is not the Messiah. That's not our job as pastors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We are called to walk faithfully along congregations. But just because I am young and I have young children doesn't mean that the young families in the town are going to flock to the congregation where I am serving. Just because I'm young and I have young kids,
right.
that's not quite what I am called to do.
Right. And maybe there's a difficult realization for congregations or for church folk, for us in general, that like Jesus hasn't necessarily promised the things that we want or think Jesus should do. I mean, like sometimes people are like, well, if our church is thriving, we will automatically have this program or this program or this program or this program. And to go, we might, but not necessarily. Jesus hasn't promised that every congregation will have this or this or this or this. And maybe there's something uncomfortable about it, but like we're kind of disappointed. We want Jesus to fix all our problems. And it turns out Jesus gets to decide what are the things that he's come to address and what are the things we're going to have to live with. That's an uncomfortable realization that like Jesus seems to think the things that are worth attending to deal with, forgiveness of sins and of making people whole, but not necessarily, per our last conversation, a raise for me, a promotion, and a bigger house. You know, like I should get used to the idea that just because I want it doesn't mean that Jesus has promised it. And that's a difficult learning too for our faith. There's this scene in The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky, where the one character imagines a sort of a thought experiment that Jesus comes back during the time of the Spanish in the Spanish Inquisition, and the High Inquisitor is interrogating Jesus, and basically by the end of this exchange in this sort of thought experiment, tells Jesus, "Go off. We don't need you anymore. We have the church, so we don't need you anymore. You mess things up. The church will dole out salvation. The church will give out things. Go away." And it ends with this like haunting moment where I think Jesus kisses the High Inquisitor and then walks away. They're about to kill Jesus again. They're going to crucify him again. And it's this haunting, difficult moment, but like. Part of what I keep coming back to when I think about that part of the book, is this exact temptation to want to make ourselves the savior and to make Jesus irrelevant. Of okay, Jesus said all this stuff a long time ago, but we've got here, buy our program, buy our whatever, come to our thing, and we'll fix your life. Rather than we need to be satisfied with what Jesus has to offer us. And again, it's that recognizing of the role, like you said, Sarah, of being John the Baptist rather than replacing Jesus.
There's a meme. It's a cartoon. By a guy who calls himself Naked Pastor. He does all these drawings about the church and Jesus, and it's a whole bunch of people inside a church pushing up against the door, and Jesus on the outside trying to push his way in. And they say, "Don't let him in. He's going to change everything." And that makes me think of that scene from Brothers Karamazov. We think that we have it down. We know how, we've been doing this Christianity thing for 2,000 years, so we know how it works. And yet, so often we fall short of what Jesus calls us to do, and we aren't willing to allow Jesus to change us so then we can have change the world.
In some ways, it feels like a lot of these temptations we've looked at over this series kind of have ways that they interconnect or may feed on each other. Because I think about the anecdote you shared a while back, Sarah, about being in that congregation where the first thing they talked about was the coffee bar, and being like, okay, I'm not sure Jesus is anti-coffee bar, but like if that's your lead, it sounds like what Jesus has equipped us to do is to caffeinate the world rather than to share the news and way of Jesus. Which again feels like it's another way of saying what Jesus offers, we honestly think isn't enough or isn't good enough. So instead, we have to offer Jesus and a latte. And again, nobody maybe intended it that way, but if it lands that way, it sort of sounds like what you're saying is we don't think Jesus is adequate. What we have to offer is Jesus and these accessories. And again, that feels like that's casting ourselves as savior rather than letting Jesus be enough. So I guess I want to ask briefly then, all these temptations we've looked at in this series, because here we are coming to the end of this, are there anecdotes, are there things that the church does or that we do that try and help to resist or fight against or to say no to any or all of these temptations that are part of our regular life as either church leaders, as pastors, or as individual personal Christians? What helps us to deal with them other than just naming them?
I think for me in particular, when I feel like I'm being put into the role of savior, or when I feel like I should be the savior, is to remind myself that I'm not, and remind myself of what I can and cannot do. So again, remind myself that I'm more John the Baptist than Jesus in any reading that I'm doing. But it's also, I like to think of ministry as teamwork, that it is something that I am doing alongside of other people, not me doing all of the work. So, when it does feel like I am doing more than I should be doing, then that means I just need to be better at drawing other people in or inviting other people into this work that we are called to do together. So that's usually where I start.
I think some of it, and this is where I wish that our liturgical life is a little bit more like y'all's. I miss the liturgy of my old connection, and one particular line of the liturgy surrounding communion in the United Methodist Church. When we get to the part where we talk about the Last Supper, when we talk about Maundy Thursday, it said, on the night he gave himself up for us, which every other liturgy I've ever encountered and read, it's on the night in which he was betrayed. Both are true. But like that line just always stuck with me about the sacrificialness of Jesus's entire life, and especially of his death. It's not something that was forced upon him, it's something that he chose. And so keeping that idea of sacrifice and being willing to make that sacrifice when Jesus calls us to, helps to keep me from becoming the savior, trying to be the savior myself, keeps me from thinking that, everything good should happen because I'm a Christian, I should only have good things happen in my life. It keeps that power balance in place for me. And my new connection doesn't have, well, we don't have our own liturgy per se, but the liturgy I'm using now doesn't have that. And who knows, I might have to change it back and put that back in there. Because I that's something I really, really loved about the liturgy of the UMC was to just that one line, and how it just changed that whole night and the way I look at it.
To me, it feels like this is part of the reason why here we are coming to the end of Lent, about to be into the midst of the drama that is called Holy Week or the Great 3 Days. This is part of why that story keeps getting retold. Is that in a way, this is part of the anecdote for any of these temptations. And I don't just mean sit through a bunch of church services, but like the restorying that happens reminds us, oh yeah, number one, this is a story centered on Jesus, and that we aren't the stars of the show. Jesus is the one who saves. But also look at the way he saves. He chooses the way of suffering rather than of overt power. There's a million options for Jesus. There's a million opportunities for Jesus to make himself king or to shower people with health and wealth. And instead, he chooses this particular way. And our calling then is to let ourselves be restored by this story. This is how God saves and redeems, as cross and resurrection, and not any of the easy outs that are out there. Even though it feels kind of countercultural that every year we retell this story, even knowing what's going to happen and knowing it's sad and knowing, and like this to me feels like this is one of those parts of our church's year where real clearly it centers on Jesus is the one who is the center of attention in Jesus' story, and not, ooh, what a lovely anthem, or ooh, what a lovely, at Christmas we have a way of letting all the decorations get in the way sometimes, or the pageant or the cantata or whatever. And on other Sundays we have a way of like, oh, well, the choir sang a special song, or look, but like at this part of the year, there's this let the story speak on its own, and that has a way of, at its best, reminding us how Jesus navigates all these temptations, and maybe how our response is too. So, in these coming days, as you have the opportunity where you are, we invite you to be a part of that story. Not at any of our congregations necessarily, but wherever. We're not going to play that game of having to make ourselves savior, wherever. But be a part of that story. Let yourself be restored by what happens at the cross and resurrection. And join us next time here on Crazy Faith Talk.
See y'all.